Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
They might get there in cars or buses or on commuter rail, but as voters in Mississippi and Alabama go to the polls, it's not going to be cheap. A gallon of gas gets us going on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Tuesday, the 13th of March. It's primary day. Again, good to have you with us. A gallon of gas in Montgomery, Alabama, costs about $3.50 a gallon today. A little bit cheaper in Jackson, Mississippi. But in an election where the last time we checked the economy was still everything, pennies matter. How people feel about those extra pennies they're spending at the pump matters even more.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's here every week with us for a partnership that we call Attitude Check, what Americans really think. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So other than the fact that Americans want lower gas prices, what do we know about how it affects how they're going to vote? Is that something we take into the polls with us?
You know, it certainly can be, but unlike some of the conventional wisdom, Kai, that's been developing here in recent days, yeah. We don't see so far that the price of gasoline is this gigantic mental concern on the part of Americans and voters out there. One of the reasons I say that is we ask every month, what's the most important problem facing the country?
Mm-hmm.
And this month, 7% mentioned gas prices. Overwhelmingly, people are much more likely to say the economy and unemployment, and that 7% is way down from where it's been, say, you know, it's 25% in June of 2008.
Well, but riddle me this, though. If we're paying, national average 4.25, right? National average now, which is like 380. But if it goes up 50 cents, do you have a barometer? Is there some bar that will be passed and then people are going to change their minds?
We ask Americans that. We actually said, what is the price point at which, and this is the way we phrased it, your lifestyle will be significantly changed or yeah. You'll have to significantly stop spending in other areas? And on average, it was $5.30.
Wow.
Not $4.50 or $4.30, but $5.30. Now, of course, a lot of Americans, lower income, said lower numbers than that.
Yeah, of
but
course.
That's the median, and the average is right above $5.
So if I'm running Exxon today, man, I'm going to raise prices tomorrow, right?
Yeah, you can push prices right up to $5.29. How's that? And
yeah.
You won't tip over to that point. Looks like you're going to have a 5 on that gas sign as you drive down the road before it really begins to affect your consumer behavior.
That's kind of amazing. Back to the politics of this thing, though. What you're hearing out on the campaign stump from Republicans and a bit from the president yesterday morning is all about energy independence and increasing supply. What do voters think about, you know, drilling more and all the rest of that?
Well, when it comes to drill, Americans prefer the alternative, and that's, of course, what Obama knows. Every March, we update some indicators, and we just finished updating right now. Would you think the best way to handle the energy situation is to emphasize more production or mm-hmm. to emphasize conservation or to emphasize alternative energy sources? And both of the latter went out. In other words, by about 51-40, Americans say conservation rather than more production. And by even higher than that, 59%-34, Americans say emphasize alternative energy rather than more production. So the Republican emphasis on drilling doesn't comport well with the American attitudes at this point.
Yeah. The politics of energy policy in the 2012 election, I guess. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. You can find out more about the data they use and their polling on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
On Wall Street today, traders went and got happy when nobody was looking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to make a cell phone or an electric guitar or wind turbines or guided missiles, all of which are in varying demand throughout the wider world, you got to be able to get your hands on something called rare earth metals. China has the lion's share of them, about a third of global supply or so. In a complaint to the World Trade Organization today, President Obama said the limits that Beijing has put on rare earth exports is, quote, breaking the rules. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has more now on how China got the rare earth upper hand.
You may have heard it here before. Rare earths actually aren't rare. They're beneath the ground everywhere, including China. Yaron Varona is with the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, which is hosting an industry conference today.
China only has, I'd say, about a third of the world's rare earths. However, they are by far the leading producer of rare earths.
Just 25 years ago, American companies were mining this stuff and processing it. But then U.S. firms shut down, and the business went to China.
Deng Xiaoping was famously quoted saying, "The Middle East has oil and China has rare earths." And so they really put a strategic emphasis on developing that.
China threw subsidies at the sector, built it up. And they're widely believed to have cut environmental corners. Gareth Hatch at Technology Metals Research explains, to process the minerals, you dump chemicals on top.
It's called leaching. And if you're not careful with the runoff or the residue from those processes, those reagents can end up in the water table, they can end up in the soils.
We're talking dangerous byproducts like uranium and thorium. So the industry moved to China, and it keeps going. Just days ago, the mining firm Molycorp bought a Canadian processing firm based in China. Here's Molycorp CEO Jim Sims.
We would all like it more if end product manufacturers that use rare earth materials were in the U.S. or other countries. But after decades of attrition, it just isn't really the case anymore. It's not reality.
But here's the thing. China capped exports, prices went up, and markets reacted. Companies again started mining rare earths outside China, in places like Australia and California, and more supply will come online. So why pick a trade fight now? Industry lobbyist Jeff Green says it could backfire if the Chinese
refused to allow additional exports of that material. We've now fed the very system that we had concerns about in the first place.
There's a fear here that a trade spat on behalf of U.S. industry could hurt U.S. industry. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Turns out the ad slogan, "Got milk?" might actually be an understatement, because that dairy industry marketing hook has never rung more true for American farmers. Herds in this country are producing milk at record levels, so consumers suffering sticker shock at the gas station might be able to find some solace at the supermarket. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more now on the falling price of a gallon of milk.
It's a beautiful day in upstate New York, and Mike McMahon, a dairy farmer there, took a break to talk to me about the falling price of milk.
It's an interesting thing about the dairy industry. You can sell every drop of milk you make. You might not make any money on it, but you can sell all of it.
Last year, McMahon's farm, Easy Acres Dairy, sold 16 million pounds of milk. All of it goes to Greek yogurt maker Chobani. This year, his 650 cows are still productive, but the farm could be less profitable. The UN says the only food group to drop in price last month was dairy. Why?
One big factor has been the extremely mild winter.
That's dairy economist Bill Brooks. He says consumers like warm winters because we save on heating costs. Turns out cows like warm weather, too, for their own reasons. Cameron Threen is a dairy economist at Ohio State University.
Cows respond well when they're not out slogging around in bitterly cold winds or difficult times.
Like fighting off sickness. Threen says last year was a strong year for milk sales, so American farmers added to their dairy herds. Now we've got too much milk. But you can't turn off a cow. That creates a game of, yes, chicken between farmers and their buyers.
The buying side, they will sort of step out of the game for a bit, because why buy today if I anticipate that prices will be even lower tomorrow?
Causing prices to drop even more. But for consumers, there's a lag of a few months before those savings make their way onto grocery store shelves. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We did a story yesterday that caught a lot of people's ears about something happening at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas this week. Homeless Hotspot is the headline. Homeless people in Austin acting as wireless internet hotspots, selling Wi-Fi access, and then getting to keep the money. As often happens, there was way more to that story than met the ear, which we learned by talking to the guy who thought up the idea. Today, one of the men who was part of it, Dusty White, has been living at a homeless shelter in Austin for about a month now. Mr. White, it's good to have you with us.
Good. It's a pleasure to.
So tell me what you think about this program. I mean, when they came to the shelter and said, listen, we've got this idea for homeless hotspots, what'd you think?
I thought it was an excellent program. I mean, it gave me a little bit of recognition, and not only that, it was a positive attitude interacting with people.
Yeah. So tell me how it works in practice. I mean, you're walking around Austin, whatever you're doing, and somebody sees your T-shirt and they've got a laptop and they say, "Hey, man, I need some Wi-Fi." Is that basically how it goes?
That's correct. Yes, sir. I carry a device. It was just a human satellite Wi-Fi, and we helped out quite a bit.
How's it working for you? I mean, are you making money out of this thing?
Yes, sir. I'm a people person. I like to interact. I've always been in some kind of communication. It was very nice interacting with a lot of people. I mean, I met people from Denmark. I met people from Germany, England, London.
So you've had a lot of business then?
Oh, I have had a lot of business. And the promotion was our shirts.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw our shirts or you'll play.
I've seen pictures, yeah.
Yeah, yes, sir. I mean, that's where a lot of people were kind of curious. They were very intrigued by it. They, you know, at first they were kind of hesitated, but once they started talking to them, explaining your situation and explaining what we were doing, they took the time to talk to us.
And the thing that got us, actually, was the T-shirts and the headlines that you saw yesterday about, oh, my God, they're turning homeless people in Austin into Wi-Fi hotspots. And it seemed a little right. You're chuckling, right? I mean,
yes,
it was
sir.
A little bit, wow, really?
Well, you know, you got to understand, a lot of these guys that are here at this shelter at this point in time or in this homeless situation are educated people. I used to mm-hmm. think of they were bums or they were too lazy to work or there was some kind of mental issue. Now I've seen a different outlook, of the homeless population. I mean, this is all new to me. I've been homeless for about a month and a half in my life. And it's not what you achieve in life, sir. It's what you overcome.
So did the mainstream media get it wrong yesterday with, oh, my God, this is horrible. Look what they're doing. Did we blow that?
Yes, sir. I feel like that was yes, sir, I do. I mean, all the persons that participated in this program here at the Front Step program.
Yeah, Front Step is the shelter, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, sir. And every one of them enjoyed it. And they're still talking about it, you know, and they would do it again.
Dusty White, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much, sir.
This is radio, so you can't see this, but I'm kind of stifling a yawn here as I tell you that the Federal Reserve ended its meeting today. Nothing new to report on the economy. But then at the end of the day, Mr. Bernanke and company showed they still got it, it being the ability to surprise the markets. The Fed released the results of its stress tests on U.S. banks 2 days early. Turns out American banks are in a much better position financially than we thought. In fact, if it were 2008 all over again, they'd do a lot better this time around. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here with more on the story. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So this is the financial equivalent of, you know, putting you on the treadmill, right?
Yes, exactly. They wanted to see how strong these banks were, checking whether they're healthy, whether they're ready to put on their big boy pants and be real banks again. And more importantly, whether they could survive another Lehman Brothers.
Was it that explicit, survive another Lehman Brothers? Because nobody likes to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, it's referred to as the recent unpleasantness, I'm sure. But the Fed didn't use the words Lehman Brothers, but they did describe a trading shock scenario where a major financial institution would fall apart between June and December 2008. So you can guess.
Right.
And it only tested the six biggest banks on that, Goldman, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley. And they all passed. Citigroup, however, was the weakest and it will have to raise more capital. So I guess you could say actually Citigroup didn't pass.
Yeah. When you say passed, is that like with a D minus or with an A?
It's hard to say because all of these are numbers that can kind of shift. But for instance, we can take two banks that did get an A, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo, and they went running with their report cards all up and down Wall Street.
Yeah.
That's why the Fed had to announce today.
Right. And you'll hear in the numbers coming up that J.P. Morgan reaped a little bit of the benefit of that. I mean, it's a little bit, really, you're doing that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of the bank stocks, bank stocks are up 17% this year, and they were down all of last year. So they're looking for any optimism.
Yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty a little bit. What did these stress tests stress, if I might?
Sure, absolutely. Well, first they stressed the 19 biggest banks, the ones with $50 billion in assets or more, mm-hmm. and then they asked them to picture a scenario like that June to December 2008 scenario, and even worse. So unemployment at 13%, 50% drop in the stock market, a housing market decline of 21%, and then on top of that, let's add a European crisis, and then figure out what they would take in losses on loans if people didn't pay back their loans, and what would happen if they got sued, what would happen if their computers fell apart, all of these different factors.
Riddle me this. Are these real stress tests, or are they like the first batch that came out, you know, 2.5, 3 years ago, which was really not so much of a test at all?
Right. That had that great Saturday Night Live joke. They went to a simple pass-pass system.
Right.
This time, it is a stress test. Everyone kind of agrees on that. And what's more, if a passage of Dodd-Frank actually happens, there's a clause in there that says that the banks will have to do this every year. So they haven't done this since 2009. But if we see the right regulations come through, they're going to have to be on top of it every year. And that's going to be very real.
They test themselves or the Fed supervises?
Both. They test themselves and the Fed supervises.
All right. Well, you get the best of both worlds. Heidi Moore in New York City for us. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, the ups and downs of private development at public universities.
I was like, either I can get a little small dorm and have a little bit more change in my pocket, or I can like live in a nice dorm where I'm happy and be broke.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, well, look, you heard the music. Stocks had their best day of the year today. The Dow Industrials jumped 217 points, about 1.2%, finished at 13,177. There's that 13,000 mark again. The NASDAQ shot up 56 points, 1.8%, ended at 3039. The S&P 500 charged ahead 24 points, also 1.8%, reached 1395. Forget 13,000, by the way. Pay attention to that NASDAQ 3000 mark. That's the bigger one. As we mentioned earlier, most banks passed the Federal Reserve stress test. Shares of JPMorgan Chase bounded up 7% on its passing grade, and news it's going to raise dividends and buy back stock. Goldman Sachs also had high marks. Banked more than 6% today. Wells Fargo galloped up 5.75%. February retail sales logged the biggest gains in 5 months. Shares of Sears bulked up nearly 3% today. Target up 0.8%. Walmart and Macy's each packaged about 0.5% higher. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.13%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. British Prime Minister Cameron is in Washington for an official visit at the White House. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee discusses ending homelessness among veterans. And with all the change in our lives, it's nice to know that there is a constant. A mathematical constant, that is. Tomorrow is Pi Day. Go celebrate that. Woohoo! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Alabama and Mississippi have the big primaries today, and we came across an interesting statistic in the course of our election research the other day. More than a third of the people in those two states get publicly funded health care through either Medicare or Medicaid. That gets us to today's commentary, in which we're asking regular people all week, not analysts or pundits or journalists, what they want out of this election.
My name is Emma Williams. I'm 61 years old. I'd like the candidates to know that they should leave Medicare alone. Medicare for me is very important because I'm not the healthiest person in the world. Like I said, I'm 61 years old. And with age come diseases. I'm hypertensive. I have diabetes. Being able to get the health care that I need is very important to me. I'm now on Medicare, Medicaid totally because I'm disabled because of my back. We've worked for this Medicare. We've worked many years. I myself for 30 years, I worked for this money. And the money's dwindling anyway because they've used our money up. They're wanting to pull from Medicare for this and drop this. what happens when the care that I need, they're no longer available? What happens? And not just for me, for everybody in the United States that's on Medicare, on Medicaid. I'm really afraid that it's going to be a lot of cutbacks. At one time, I was without insurance of any kind, and I had to pay for medications out of my pockets, and it was a nightmare. So I won't complain, but like I said, it frightens me with this election year. Where is the Medicare and Medicaid going?
Emma Williams is retired. She's a full-time grandma now in Kansas City, Missouri. Her story was produced for us by Sylvia Maria Gross. Tell us what matters most to you in this election. Marketplace.org is the website. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Among the many rites of passage that college brings, the very first one might be the most shocking. The dorm room. Cinder block walls, bunk beds, showers down the hall, learning to live with a bunch of complete strangers. For students nowadays, that's just not cutting it. But sprucing up real estate isn't exactly in a lot of college budgets. So schools are turning to private companies to give dorms an extreme makeover. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Last fall, the Board of Trustees at the University of Kentucky in Lexington took a tour of the campus dorms. They were shocked to see rooms like this.
We got a closet and two windows, but, you know, you can almost touch both walls when you reach across.
Matt Longacre is director of Patterson Hall. It was built more than a century ago. The room is about the size of a Volkswagen bus.
Part of the reason this room is empty is because nobody wants to live in a space like this.
The average dorm at UK is almost 50 years old. Group showers, concrete block walls, dingy carpets. After their tour, the board ordered a massive overhaul.
They said this had to be a priority.
Angela Martin is treasurer at the University of Kentucky.
If we want to recruit and retain top students, these students are coming from homes where they've had their own bedroom, their own bathroom, and the thoughts of sharing a bathroom with 45 other people just is not appealing.
The state university, squeezed by budget cuts, couldn't afford a wholesale upgrade. So instead, the school decided to lease a chunk of land to a private company called Education Realty Trust. EDR will build and manage two new dorms and share the profits with the university.
The developer can build it cheaper and operate it cheaper, even with building in a profit. This is what they do.
If all goes well, EDR may eventually replace most of the university's 6,000 beds and add 3,000 more. Now, if this were Extreme Makeover College Edition, this is when people would start shouting. And a giant bus would pull out of the frame to reveal brand new luxury dorms. But they're not built yet. So I went to see another dorm built by EDR at the University of Louisville, about an hour and a half drive to the west.
We are in the lobby of Betty Johnson Hall. We have two fitness rooms and a TV room as well. If you walk out the other side of the lobby, you will walk into our pool and patio area, and we'll kind of...
Teresa Crum is community manager for the EDR dorms. With mottled tan wallpaper and pink and purple carpet, Betty Johnson Hall feels more like a hotel or retirement home than a dorm. Students live in apartments. I find freshman Whitney Arian sprawled on a couch watching MTV.
I wanted to live here because we get our own rooms, our own bathrooms, a nice little kitchen, and a living room area where we can just lounge whenever we want to, and it's just like being at home.
She shares the kitchen and living room with a roommate. The bathroom is all hers, decked out with zebra print shower curtain and bath mat. The dorm is co-ed, but the privacy seems to attract a lot of women.
Betty Johnson, oh yeah. They known for their the cute girls, so another thing I enjoy about living here.
Sophomore Gino Williams says he works at Taco Bell and Foot Locker to help cover the bill. His double with a shared bathroom costs about $600 more a semester than a traditional dorm.
I was like, either I can get a little small dorm and have a little bit more change in my pocket, or I can like live in a nice dorm where I'm happy and be broke. So I guess I chose broke.
Plenty of students, or their parents, are making that choice. University of Louisville president Jim Ramsey says the privately run dorms are pretty much full, and he says they've helped his school attract a different caliber of student. The average ACT score of incoming students is up. So are graduation rates.
At the end of the day, it all ties back to what we're trying to accomplish academically, that is, recruit the very best students, have them on campus, and engaged in campus life, because that's going to increase their academic performance and get them to ultimately graduation.
Students may not even notice if a private company takes over their dorm. They still have student RAs and campus events like any dorm. But when college students act like college students, punching holes in the walls to hang their flat-screen TVs or spilling beer all over the rug, then the difference becomes really clear. The folks who come to clean it up will be from EDR. The university is out of that business. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in line with the expensive liquids theme in the show today, gas, milk, now wines. British Prime Minister David Cameron is in town this week. He and President Obama are going to an NCAA basketball tournament game in Ohio tonight. And then tomorrow, the traditional state dinner at the White House, at which they will toast each other with, well, we don't know, so we can't tell you. It seems the tradition of publishing the wine list at state dinners ended a year or so ago when a bottle of Cabernet served at a dinner for Chinese President Hu Jintao retailed for $399. Not the message you want in a down economy, I guess. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 217 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ shot up 56 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 charged ahead 24 points, 1.8%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. You can listen to them tomorrow. Listen to us tomorrow afternoon. We'll see you back. Bye-bye. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.